Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another round of Your Cases on Hold. We're looking here today for the May 21st episode, and we're happy to be coming here with you. Just as a disclosure, all the ideas here are our own. They don't belong to JBJS, JBJS editorial board, or anyone else. They are truly our opinions. I'm Antonia Chen. I'm deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction, and we have here...
I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor of Methods, and I dig your style.
We like it.
Yeah.
Brought to you by the Miller Review course. Get your learn on. They have great class courses coming up. If you're taking your board exams, this is a course that's a must go to. You'll learn a lot and you'll pass your boards. And that's what matters the most. Starting with the top of the pile, we got a lot of information coming at you. Traditional Bone Setters, Risk, Complications, and the Way Forward by Pretrosor, and it's permanently free. What's New in Foot and Ankle Surgery by Scott, and it's permanently free. Risk factors for amputation and prolonged hospitalization among children who receive traditional bone setting in Ethiopia by Adim, and it's free for 30 days. What's important? When humor goes wrong by Kyoto, which is permanently free. And you want to know someone who's funny? That's Chris Kyoto. Treat the Patient Instead of the Disease by Rasmussen, permanently free. Pregnancy and Childbearing for Orthopedic Surgeons, Challenges and Successful Support Initiatives by Cristofaro. And there are three evidence-based orthopedic articles. One is Access to Orthopedic Devices in Low and Middle-Income Countries, The Challenges and Opportunities by Dworkin. Intravenous dexamethasone transiently elevates blood glucose levels and reduces pain after total knee arthroplasty in patients with type 2 diabetes, a randomized control study by Park et al. And there's a commentary, and it's free for 30 days. Interesting to look at because typically we won't give dexamethasone in our type 2 diabetic patients. Similar functional results in patients outside the classical criteria for medial unicompartmental knee arthroplasty by Van Noli et al. Open reduction of hip dislocation is associated with higher rates of proximal femoral growth disturbance in patients with arthrogryposis multiplex congenita than idiopathic DDH, a dual center retrospective cohort study by Taylor et al. Molecular evidence supporting MEK inhibitor therapy in NF1 pseudoarthrosis by Paria et al. And there's a visual summary. Effects of sustained tensile distraction on vertebrae and intervertebral disc growth, an in vivo study using a mouse tail model by Solari. And outcomes of lumbosacral hemivertebral resection and short segmental fusion to skeletal maturity by Zhang et al. Efficacy of vitamin C as glucocorticoid substitute for reducing pain and inflammation after total hip arthroplasty, a randomized controlled trial by Jiang et al. And outcomes of calcaneal lengthening osteotomy in ambulatory patients with cerebral palsy and planovalgus foot deformity by Park et al. That gives us all the background. We still have headlines in front of us, the Your Cases on Hold featurette, and we also have our honorable mentions. So that
you know, when I was in residency, and you may have had this in residency experience as well, we would every month we would have a journal club where we just went through JBJS articles. And so this is, you know, going back 20 years and even 20 years plus. And, you know, there was a monthly at that time. It wasn't in the biweekly publication modality that it is now. And like each issue of JBJS was like a small textbook at that point when it was a monthly. And then when they went initially to the biweekly, this was now after residency, like it became like a comic book size. That's like, I mean, they changed what they were publishing and like they no more published case reports or things like that, but it was like, wow. And now, I mean, I don't know how many people, you know, my JBJS is electronic now. I don't know how many people are getting the print version, but I feel like the bi-monthly issues with this number of articles, they have to be getting back to like the pre-size of what the monthly issue was. That's the beauty of electronic publishing. You don't have to worry about like the print pages and things like that. You can do more when it's on the cloud. Or
do you remember Encyclopedia Britannica? We had to look everything up.
Yeah.
That was a good way to go. I still have those, interestingly enough. They are sitting in my home, so go figure. All right. So why don't you tell us about your headline, Risk of Postoperative Nausea and Vomiting After Total Hip or Knee Arthroplasty Under Spinal Anesthesia, randomized trial comparing conventional antiemetics with or without the ME term bracelet. It's by Yang et al. There's a commentary, an infographic, and it's free for 30 days. Tell us more.
That's the JBJS perfecta. If you want to get down to your racing terminology, making some bets at the horse racing. So this study is a randomized trial looking at the use of this emeterm bracelet, which relies on AccuPoint technology. So it's like a beautiful dovetailing of different treatment philosophies and worlds, very ancient traditional medicine approaches applied in the context of modern day medicine. So I love that. So this is AccuPoint stimulation, and this has been shown to reduce the risk of postoperative nausea and vomiting after various types of surgeries that you rely on general anesthesia. Obviously, this is in a cohort that's involving spinal anesthesia, so that's the pivot, that's the study question. And they identified patients at moderate or high risk for postoperative nausea and vomiting, 195 patients undergoing total hip and 153 undergoing total knee, randomized to receive routine antiemetics, that's dexamethasone and ondansetron, alone or in conjunction with the emeterm bracelet. So it wasn't just the AccuPoint bracelet alone. Obviously, a simple intervention, a low-cost intervention, conceivably. So they did a sample size calculation, and they found that each arm would require at least 87 participants undergoing total hip and 70 undergoing total knee. And then they increased those minimal samples to a total of 200 and 160 respectively to account for potential withdrawal or losses to follow-up. Now, we've discussed this before, you know, in studies like this, where it's like it's a total joint population and the pathophysiology is sort of central or earlier in the pathway. And we're talking about postoperative nausea and vomiting. Is there some kind of conceivable rationale as to the nausea vomiting is worse in total hips versus total knees? I mean, total joints is kind of total joints from my spine viewpoint. So I don't understand the need to have like the different groups with like specific numbers that, you know, are reasonable. You don't want every patient, a total hip patient with three total knees and then be like, oh, it's good for everybody, but like a reasonable number. I don't know that you need specific numbers in both. That said, they didn't actually hit their numbers, which to me seems like a little bit of a misstep and sort of an unforced error, because they said they needed at least 87 undergoing total hip and 70 undergoing total knee in each arm. And then they increased those numbers. So had they still wouldn't have hit the numbers had they not increased them, but they would have been a lot closer than where they were with 195 and 153. I don't think that that is that a big deal for this study. Just from a methodology standpoint, when you have issues with power, you're more concerned when there's not a significant finding. When you do have a significant finding, by definition, you were sort of powered to find that, right? The only concern that would apply here is that, well, maybe there was, you know, some limitations in inappropriate clinical variation. The numbers are close enough that I don't think you can make that case either. Anyway, in the antiemetic and emeterm bracelet group, there were significant reductions in postoperative nausea and vomiting, 16% compared with almost 32%, so like a 50% reduction. And then severe postoperative nausea and vomiting was 1% in the emeterm group compared with 8% in the conventional group. And then the need for antiemetic rescue was 3% in the emeterm group versus 14% in the conventional group. So their conclusion, which is appropriate, emeterm bracelet enhanced the efficacy of antiemetics in reducing postoperative nausea and vomiting and may improve short-term recovery. I think that's particularly salient in our environment where these are being done increasingly, or total joint replacements of a certain type are being done increasingly outpatient, and you want to enhance throughput and you know, have them get through the PACU expeditiously. And, you know, potentially in some of these situations, patients may have to be, if they have uncontrollable nausea and vomiting, and certainly uncontrollable vomiting, they're going to get admitted. I don't recall that it said, you know, how much these would cost. And certainly this was done in China. So what the cost there versus what the cost would be here is probably somewhat different. But it seems to me like it's an intuitive low-cost intervention. And maybe you don't even need the Emmeterm bracelet. You know, they sell all those like over-the-counter bracelets that they use for that work on, I'm assuming, the same acupressure point on the wrist. They sell them for, you know, airplane travel and boat travel. So you might not actually need this specific branded bracelet, but you could do it off the cuff. Low-cost interventions, that's where it's at.
Way to go. You made an interesting point about the hips versus knees that make a huge difference. I think the only thing that would probably make a difference is positioning, potentially, of patients. Like a supine position for a hip and a supine position of a knee may be the same, but if they're lateral decubitus on their side, that could be good or bad. I'm not sure. And then duration of case. For some people, they might take longer to do a hip, longer to do a knee, something like that. That could be the difference there too. So that's something to think about. With regards to the difference of hips and knees, but we always like to separate them just in case it's a little bit different and someone wants to know if they're a little bit different.
Yeah. And again, I think that all just ties into that like clinical variation piece that I was speaking.
Yeah. Agreed. Let me go ahead and talk about mine, which is a little bit different. Addressing issues of inclusive workplace culture for women orthopedic surgeons in academia, a qualitative investigations by Grill et al. And there's a commentary on this as well, too. So this is a very different study in that it is a qualitative study as opposed to a quantitative study. Academic medical centers are increasingly recognizing that there's an importance of having diversity and promoting positive healthcare team dynamics as it does impact patient outcomes. There's concordance and studies that have looked at that. But orthopedics is one of the least gender diverse specialties in medicine. And there's a scarcity of women in academic orthopedics, as particularly with increasing rank, meaning there's less professors than there are associate professors than are assistant professors. And it has persisted for decades, despite multitude of different initiatives and things like that, with the idea of promoting diversity. So the purpose of the study was to conduct a qualitative study to answer the following questions. What aspects of workplace culture enhance or distract from building an inclusive workplace for women surgeons in academic orthopedics? And what are the essential components of creating inclusive workplaces in academic orthopedics? The participants were all women who were orthopedic surgeons in the United States, who either actively hold an academic position or previously held an academic position, but subsequently left academics. Purposive sampling strategy was used until thematic saturation was reached to obtain a sample of women of various academic ranks, races and ethnicities, subspecialties, geographic regions, and institutions. Meaning they sampled into people, they reached out to people, they used these sampling strategies, including respondent-driven snowball sampling, which you ask participants to suggest other participants within their networks, and intensifying sampling or key informant sampling, selecting participants who have certain expertise and experiences. And they kept interviewing multiple people until they saturated and the themes kept repeating themselves. There were 40-minute virtual semi-structured interviews conducted from December 2023 to April 2024. And data was analyzed using grounded theory methodology to develop a conceptual model of inclusive culture. Data analysis occurred in three steps. There was coding of raw data, combining and categorizing codes into larger thematic frameworks, and forming a conceptual model based on the themes. 35 women were approached for participation and 26 participated for a 74% participation rate. 81% are currently in academia and 19% had left academia. 12 identified as Asians and 23 identified as underrepresented in medicine. The model of inclusive workplace culture was built on two interrelated pillars. So pillar number one was supportive structures and pillar number two was social inclusions. This is seen in figure one. The first pillar of supportive structures is primarily under direction of department leaders and includes themes of intentional career development, valuing diverse contributions, transparent policies such as parental pay and leave, and building department cohesiveness. The idea here, though, is there's a need for attention to equity to generate buy-in across demographic identities. Can't just have women or underrepresented minorities in it, too, but you want to have these activities or transparencies and valuing diverse contributions across all different individuals in these departments. Evaluating these diverse contributions, maybe non-traditional routes, so not just the research necessarily, the academic route or the education route, but other routes as well that people do contribute to the education and to the department as well. The second pillar is social inclusion, which relies on all members of an organization. Themes within social inclusion are respect for women, so truly listening to and believing women's experience without judgment, particularly when it comes to issues of inclusion and bias, building longitudinal relationships with colleagues, male allyship, such as including them in social events, which helps build these longitudinal relationships, women supporting women in two factors, spaces where women can discuss issues among other women, and then women supporting other women professionally, and true integration of women surgeons into departments, such as reducing siloism or addressing tokenism, i.e. don't just invite someone onto a panel because they're a woman, but invite them because they're a valued member of the department or a valued member of the team. It's also important to acknowledge that women with intersectional identities often experience more barriers in the workplace than white, cisgender, heterosexual women. So, for example, women and underrepresented minorities, a woman or disability. In other intersectionality areas, it is harder to fit in. And hostile workplace culture can take a toll on women and all individuals who experience it. It's detrimental not only to professional success, but also to well-being. And the downstream effects of burnout, career regret, dissatisfaction, and attrition have ripple effects throughout orthopedics, as women may choose to step away from the profession or leave academics, as we saw in the 90% of people who did leave academics. So in conclusion, with intentional effort, orthopedic departments can create the structures of support necessary to foster women's career success, as well as social inclusion to encourage a longevity in academia, meaning we can work on supportive structures and developing social inclusion to create these work environments that are beneficial to patients.
So, you know, from a methodology narrative standpoint, you know, this is good qualitative work. We don't see a lot of qualitative work in orthopedics, but it is certainly valuable in situations such as this. And I applaud JBJS, who has really been a singular leader in publishing qualitative research over the last 6 to 8 years, you know, among other journals in our field. I was left with a couple of thoughts, particularly really just trying to think about this in the environment where I'm working and where you used to work, because, you know, ultimately the problem with qualitative work is you're getting people's perspectives about their own environment, and it's not necessarily translational. Now, you know, with their thematic sampling to saturation and the snowball sampling and things like that, you're trying to get a broad range of perspectives. But, you know, I think a lot of what they propose, I would have loved to have seen it, you know, it's just very superficial. And I would have loved to have seen more in-depth discussion relative to the current environment in that we're all working in, where there is a drive for greater clinical productivity at the expense of social connections in general, be those in the workplace or even outside of the workplace. You know, once upon a time, if you look at like the annals of Mass General Hospital, you know, many afternoons a week, the trainees and faculty, they were like having tea with the chairman and stuff, right? So you had this nice collegial, everyone can sit around and engage, and right, they had the luxury of the time to spend doing that. There's no time for that kind of thing in today's environment. And, you know, some of these initiatives, you know, cost money. And where, you know, I would have loved for some creative ideas as to where that money comes from. I mean, ostensibly, you know, not to put you on the hot seat, but you are a chair of a department. So in terms of, you know, funding, you know, some of these initiatives, such as the, you know, you hear about like the terms like the minority tax, which is something that impacts women regardless of other intersectionalities that they may have in their persona, but then even more so for those who do have intersectionality. How do you pay for that?
And that's the hard.
You are a chair. Don't say you don't know.
I have been chair. You know, it's one of those things.
Power.
Well, that's one of those interesting things, right? People always say, well, what is the money that we make go to? You know, and I want to make as much of it go to you. Like, if people talk about profit and loss model, right, when it comes to private practice. Now, there's two ways that we be able to pay for it. One of it is we use some of the medical group funds to pay for it, meaning some of the what you bring in, we pay you a certain amount, and we help you to use pay your PA, AP, APPs, your medical assistants, your surgical schedulers, that sort of stuff. So the money goes to that to make your life a little bit better without you having to pay for it. And we also take some of that money for wellness activities. One of the things that we actually use it for, we get our money from, is from our endowments. So there's some really generous people who've given endowments of chairs. And as long as we use it for a certain reason, we can hold things like hold our holiday party, or we can hold our, gathering, or I can support a, social gathering of the residents and the faculty and things like that. The hardest part is getting everyone together, to your point, right? There's only so many hours in a day. There's only so many things that you can come to. And you're like, it's yet another, activity on a weekday night that you want to be spending with your colleagues, or you want to be spending at home with your family. And so it is a struggle in that way, money aside, but we do find ways to find funds to fulfill this, but it does take a little bit of effort for sure.
Part one is the understanding the importance, the motivation and the drive. And so, JBJS is doing a great job, and these authors did a great job in terms of putting their finger on that particular trigger.
They did. All right. Moving on to the Your Cases on Hold featurette, rates of periprosthetic joint infection and revision increase after arthroscopic lysis of adhesions subsequent to primary total knee arthroplasty. By Nakam et al., there's a commentary and it's free for 30 days. So we're going to switch gears a little bit, obviously, and go back to quantitative math here. Arthrofibrosis occurs after total knee replacements, which is stiffness after a total knee replacement, typically defined as not being able to achieve 90 degrees of flexion after a total knee replacement. It's typically treated by manipulation or anesthesia first, followed by lysis of adhesions. Although the rate of deep infection after knee arthroscopy in native knees has been reported as low as 0.22%, the rate of infection after knee arthroscopy in patients who underwent total knee replacement have been reported as high as 6.3%. So pretty big change there. So this study compared periprosthetic joint infection, or PJI, and revision outcomes in total knee arthroplasty patients who underwent total knee arthroplasty with arthroscopic lysis of adhesions and those who did not undergo these arthroscopic lysis of adhesions. These authors used the Pearl Diver database to identify patients who undergone a primary total knee between 2016 and 2021. Patients were only included in the arthroscopic lysis of adhesion group if the lysis of adhesion occurred after a primary total knee arthroplasty, not after a revision total knee arthroplasty. And if they had an ICD-10 code specific for arthrofibrosis with their arthroscopy claim, so they could determine laterality versus ICD-9 codes, which did not have laterality. Patients were included in the study that had a minimum of 1 year follow-up from the primary total knee arthroplasty. The rates of periprosthetic joint infection and revision total knee arthroplasty were compared between patients who did and did not undergo these lysis of adhesions. Multivariable logistic and Cox regressions were performed, controlling for age, sex, Charleston comorbidity index, tobacco use, and a body mass index of greater than 30 kilograms per meter squared. And again, they were comparing the rates of PJI and revisions. There was a total of 383,143 patients identified, because this is the Pearl Diver database, and 703 of them had undergone an arthroscopic lysis of adhesion after a primary total knee arthroplasty. The majority of patients in each group were female, and on average, patients who underwent arthroscopic lysis of adhesions were significantly younger than those who did not. And the majority of patients in each group had commercial insurance, although the no lysis of adhesion group had a higher proportion of patients with Medicare. The mean time from index total knee arthroplasty to arthroscopic lysis of adhesion was 408 days, but it had a huge range of plus or minus 509 days, which is larger from the standard deviation. And the median time was 231 days, so less than a year. The rates of lysis of adhesion range from 0.12% in 2016 to 0.20% in 2021. Patients who underwent these lysis of adhesions had higher overall rates of periprosthetic joint infections up to 2 years of 2.1 versus 1.3%. So not as high as that 6.3% that they reported in the introduction, but definitely higher than what you would expect after a primary total knee arthroplasty, which ranges between 0.5 and 1%. And then all-cause revisions was much higher in patients who had a lysis of adhesions of 9.8% versus 1.8%. In a multivariate logistic regression analysis, the odds of PJI within 1 year after the last open or minimally invasive procedure was 2 times higher in patients who underwent laparoscopic lysis of adhesions. There was no significant difference, though, in the 1 year PJI-related revisions between groups. What was affiliated with the higher risk of periprosthetic joint infection? Younger age, higher carcinogenic comorbidity index, a BMI of greater than 30 kilograms per meter squared, tobacco use, and male sex, which is probably not surprising. In another set of multivariable logistic regression analysis, the odds of aseptic loosening related revision was 3.31 times higher, and the all-cause revision within 1 year was 5.32 times higher for patients who underwent the laparoscopic lysis of adhesion. That said, male sex was not a statistically significant risk factor for aseptic-related loosening. In a time-to-event analysis, patients undergoing lysis of adhesion had significantly higher risk of PJI, all-cause revisions, but not PJI-related revisions or aseptic loosening-related revisions. So the authors conclude that lysis of adhesion after primary total knee arthroplasty was associated with higher rates of PJI and subsequent revision surgery. That said, there's a lot of confounding variables here when it comes to why did a patient undergo a lysis of adhesion? Did they really have arthrofibrosis? They might have the diagnosis of arthrofibrosis, but did they really have a limited range of motion? Those are things that you can't get from a big database study. You also don't have race and ethnicity included in this, which does tie into arthrofibrosis. African-Americans have a higher rate of arthrofibrosis than non-African-Americans. And you also don't know why a patient underwent a lysis of adhesion or why they underwent a revision. Were they undergoing a revision because of stiffness? Did they undergo it because this one provider always goes to that? And or did they not do a manipulation first? They just went to a lysis of adhesion. So the hardest part with these large database studies is that they're not very granular, but there is still helpful information there to be cognizant of. If you're undergoing a arthroscopic lysis of adhesions, to be careful that there is an increased periprosthetic joint infection risk.
My first, sort of overarching before we get into like the nitty gritty is just, I found the discussion very uninformative, I guess, at least as pertains to the study question. So, typically in a discussion, you want to, present the results of your work within the context of the literature and what's clinically applicable or how should it play into these, how someone should apply it to their practice. That's harder to do in database studies. So that's when you're using Pearl Diver or something like that, oftentimes these authors are not alone in terms of constructing the discussion this way. But basically their paragraphs are like restating the problem, then just restating their findings. Then they just go into what I term a legalistic diatribe. You see it a lot, like if you read any kind of legal proceedings, like Supreme Court proceedings, or you get it a lot in like the Bible, like where it's like Wallig said this, but then Keynes et al. Said this, and Krieger in their study said that, and it's just like you're just kind of going through, and it's like, well, all right, fine, but how does it tie in, or how do we distill? Lavro et al. Said this, but Krieger said that, and he did it this way, and they did it that way. And you get all of these just sort of like back and forth. And in the end, you're just left with, all right, what are we supposed to do with this, right? And if you want to know a suggested better way to approaching writing discussion, you can look at An Insider's Guide to Academic Publishing in Orthopedic and Spine Surgery. But, we don't have the time to go through everything in detail.
No shameless plugs at all whatsoever.
Suffice to say, it's an underwhelming discussion when it's just, you're already telling us what we read in the results section, and then you just provide what a few other authors said, and then the limitations, and then the conclusions are restating the study. I want to go into this through an academic exercise, and sorry if this is going to run long, but we hear all the time that people are like, they need more of your cases on hold, right? They don't want it to end at 30 minutes. So I don't know if we're going to go over 30 minutes or not, but I want to work through this in an academic exercise with you because this is your field. You're a joint surgeon, and this is something that you deal with. And the authors can say whatever they want in the discussion. That is the narrative. That's their particular take and their spin. But it's Pearl Diver. So ultimately, at the end of the day, they don't really know about any one particular case any more than we know about the one particular case. So I want to work through this in a way where I'm looking at the results, just the results that they reported, and let's go through an academic exercise. So patients who underwent LOA had a significant higher odds of PJI, or what they're characterizing as PJI, aseptic loosening and all-cause revision. So the first thing is that, well, these patients are actually needing another procedure after they have the knee replacement, right? So their knee isn't perfect. Agreed? There's a problem.
Totally agree. There's something wrong going on.
Right? So isn't that already, like, that's not a risk factor. That's just a what we call a mediator or even a modulator. Sure. It's a signal that there's something wrong with this knee, that you're doing the arthroscopy potentially as a way to avoid revision surgery, but in some cases that's not going to happen. So as compared to people who are not having a problem with their knee, people aren't doing lysis of adhesions just because they feel like it. Like every third patient in your follow-up clinic, you're like, hey, we should probably do a lysis of adhesions, right? It's being done for a purpose.
And just that's for fun? Just funsies?
Maybe. You need that funding for your programming. So, but in all seriousness, this is a upstream event in a pathway that may result in this outcome. I don't believe it's an actual risk factor for the outcome. So both the aseptic loosening and the all-cause revision, to me, are not being driven by the lysis of adhesions. They are downstream events that in some respects are trying to be mitigated by the lysis of adhesions, the fact that this surgery needs to be done. Now, you're doing another surgery. You're putting poke holes and you're sticking devices into their knee. So obviously, there's going to be a higher risk of infection after that. That doesn't mean it's an infection that requires, gross purulence. And I guess it isn't, because they say there's a higher odds of PJI, but no significant difference in PJI-related revisions. So are they just calling like the superficial infection of the arthroscopy site a PJI then? Is this just a matter of semantics, right? Well, they can't know because they're not the ones giving it the label. It's just going off of the code. But I think that the signal there is, obviously, if you're having gross pus within the knee and you're going to have to take out the polyethylene at a minimum or do something more and then have the antibiotic spacer in there, you like how all this, I got all this total joint knowledge, man.
I'm actually kind of scared, but kind of impressed at the same time. You're exactly right. It's
extremely well. Yeah. Years and years spent learning at the side of Dr. Chen while I was conducting my own clinic in parallel in our shared office space.
So if it's
a PJI, what full on prosthetic joint infections do you know that don't require some type of revision surgery?
If it's truly a periprosthetic, right. Those are going to have to do it. Exactly. Yeah. Right. You actually bring up a good point too. Like, are they doing a lysis of adhesion, or are they actually doing an arthroscopic washout that they're calling a lysis of adhesion because they're doing it at the same time?
That was the next thing I was going to bring up.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. That's fine. You came to the conclusion. And then, this analytic approach where they go with logistic and then Cox is not really well substantiated. They should bring you to the same place. When you're finding, when we analyzed it this way, it told us different things than when we analyzed it the other way. That says that there's actually a problem with your substrate. That's not giving you good answers. It shouldn't be, pick whichever of these you like. We'll just tell you everything that I'd said and you decide. This one is going on hold, if that wasn't obvious from my perspective.
There was a lot of thought process in that. So yes, sorry. Hope anesthesia hasn't kept you on hold. All right, on to our honorable mentions. Pre-season patella tendon thickness predicts symptomatic patella tendinopathy in male NCAA Division I basketball players by Desiadol. This study found that increased patella tendon thickness on pre-season ultrasound was predictive of symptomatic patella tendinopathy and associated sequela during an NCAA Division I basketball season. Ultrasound identification of at-risk individuals may allow triage towards additional physical therapy and activity modification for these athletes to prevent progression to irreversible patella tendon disease. The data also supports the use of ultrasound as a screening tool for elite jumping athletes. The next is balancing tumor control and cartilage preservation for patients with giant cell tumor of bone around the knee, a clinical report from a single institute by Chen et al., not me. When managing aggressive giant cell tumor of bone around the knee joint, surgeons are often caught in a dilemma whether to perform a marginal excision or an intralesional curettage. This study found that although intralesional curettage preserved cartilage and resulted in better function, it was associated with a higher tumor recurrence rate in this series. For advanced tumors that are close to articular surface with significant subchondral bone involvement, marginal excision with unicondylar osteoarticular allograft reconstruction might be a viable alternative instead of just going for the intralesional curettage. Arthroplasty should be reserved for patients who have bicondylar involvement with severe bone and cartilage loss, making cartilage preservation impossible. And finally, magnetic intramedullary lengthening nails can be lengthened to their maximum capacity with no increased nail complications. A study of pediatric and adult populations by Dubin et al. Magnetic intramedullary lengthening nails have become an increasingly popular method for long bone distraction osteogenesis as a means for overcoming the limitations of bone lengthening with an external fixator. This study retrospectively reviewed the records of 176 pediatric patients and 109 adult patients who had undergone limb lengthening and had greater or equal to 24 months of follow-up. And the study found that full extension of the nail did not lead to increased nail bendage or breakage, and the finding was consistent whether or not they included contractures or not. There you have it. Thanks for joining us today, and we look forward to seeing you at the next one.